Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Open Floor. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, Ben Golliver. What's up, man?
Not too much, Andrew. You know, I'm really excited for today's mailbag podcast because this is the first one that's really been weighted down with all of the openfloormail at gmail.com submissions. You know, we started that email address and it really took off like wildfire. We got questions from male listeners, female listeners. I want to say five, maybe six different continents weighed in. But my big takeaway, Andrew, from these emails,
yeah,
I'm getting a little bit jealous. Or maybe that's not the right word, but there's a lot of people out there who just want to hammer on you in these emails, Andrew. That's Andrew, that's my job. Like, I don't know why these people think they can just come into our email just talking reckless. That's what I'm supposed to be here for. You guys are putting me out of business.
Look, man, they're all just trying to play along with the tone of the podcast, and I support it. I can handle it. It's totally fine. And really, thank you to everyone who wrote in. Just a historic number of questions this week for the mailbag. And we're not going to get, we'll probably get to like 20% of them, but because there's just a ton of stuff going on right now. But we really appreciate it.
Yeah,
apparently, people like email.
And we're reading all of them. So just if we don't shout you out, guys, know that we're taking all of your jokes and your hilarious stories, some of your creepy selfies. I mean, we're taking all that in stride as we go forward. You know, I was watching the Cavs the other night, game three.
Yeah.
And before they had that miraculous comeback, you know, LeBron's just going after Tristan again on some of these defensive breakdowns. And it's getting to be like clockwork where LeBron screws up. He just turns over to Tristan and starts screaming at him. I kind of felt like you're in the Tristan vibe when I'm going through some of these emails. I mean, like, you're doing a really good job of holding up and being diplomatic under unnecessary screaming from some of these people.
I'm going to just let you have this moment, all right? The Bulls are looking real solid against the Celtics, although we'll get to that. It might be complicated with the Rondo injury. Russ is struggling in Houston. The Raptors are really on the ropes right now in Milwaukee. Like, this is kind of your moment to shine. So I'm completely fine with playing the Tristan Thompson role.
Well, look, what I'm saying is we went from Loose Lips Paul last week with Paul George's amazing podium talk to stiff upper lip Andrew this week. Okay.
That's
saying I see your quiet dignity here, and I think everyone needs to appreciate that.
All right, well, let's get into the questions because the Raptors were just a disaster last night.
Oh,
I changed the channel midway through the third quarter. It was the after the Pacers-Cavs game, and I honest to God could not believe that they were down 30. That should have been a bigger story on Twitter that the Raptors were just getting destroyed. But anyways, let's get into it. So we have a batch of Raptors questions from the past 5 or 6 days. Eric says, I figured I'd send an email because I'm listening to you guys as an American living in Australia. I have one question and statement. When I watched the Raptors, you have forced me to stop actually watching the game. I now only watch DeRozan, either cheering for him to play absolutely terribly or drop 50. Game three was my favorite game of the Raptors season so far. Tyler says, regardless of how Toronto-Milwaukee plays out, can we please hear from Miguel from Montreal on the podcast again? Technically, Tyler, it was Marcos from Montreal, but we appreciate a season-long listener, so
that's
thank you for writing in.
Super long callback. What's that
yeah,
from, like,
it's a,
September?
It's a good open floor deep cut. Next question, Vinny, all caps, tell Canada to suck it. DeRozan blows. Love you, Golliver. Tell Sharp to suck it.
This is what I mean. This is the Tristan stuff right here.
Exactly. And then Thomas says, are the Bucks just better than the Raptors? They're looking like last year's OKC on defense. The Raptors are kind of looking like the Spurs. Maybe they're the best matchup against Golden State besides the Cavs. I'm not going to go that far, but how do you feel about this series in general?
Well, first things first, we got to apologize to the guy last week. You know, I made a comment about how I wasn't going to play God and then write off his friend as an idiot for thinking the Bucks had a chance in this series. And then I immediately wrote off his friend for being an idiot.
Honestly, I'm glad you said that because while we were waiting to record, I went and looked up the name of that guy. So, Lewis, your friend was right. And we were like flat out wrong in really embarrassing fashion.
Well, here's the thing. I am a noted Raptors skeptic. There's no question about that. I am a noted Bucks fanboy. There's no question about that. I choked when it came time to predict this series because I just didn't believe the Raptors were going to fall apart completely given the stakes and given how much upgrades we saw from Masai Ujiri at the deadline. I mean, it just seemed like they had done enough to survive the series against a young team that just wasn't quite there yet. But when we were responding to Lewis's question, we did kind of lay out, like, here's the blueprint for how it would work. Giannis has to be the best player on the court. Has there been any question at all that he's been the best player in that series? Not to me. I mean, he's blowing away Toronto's guards.
Yeah, he's in a completely different category than anyone else in that series.
And then we discussed the importance of Middleton and how length might play a factor. And then we also talked about the question mark with Lowry being, you know, reinserted and how does that kind of change roles. And it hasn't necessarily been a combustion because of the other guys who've been upset because Lowry's back in there, like I kind of speculated. But it has been real choppy in terms of like offensive responsibility. How do the lineups work? And, you know, Lowry is kind of going out and forcing shots and being kind of proud of it. And that's been a consistent problem throughout his career in the playoffs. Not even I, Mr. 46, thought DeRozan was going to be unable to make a single field goal from the game during what I would consider to be a must-win playoff game in game three in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
I mean, he's sitting on the bench looking lifeless, zoned out. And I guess the question is, like, during that situation, you're getting blown out in game three. You know, it's not even close. And so you have a lot of time to reflect on the bench. Usually that's the moment where you're like, you know, getting yourself already mentally prepared for game four. To me, I think the biggest question for Toronto, do they have a plan B here? I mean, how do they unlock DeRozan given these matchups? How do they, I mean, they're just like closing their eyes and praying that Lowry figures it out. What are their backup plans? How does this get going back on the right direction? And I'm skeptical that they've got that. And it's for the same reason I've been skeptical of DeRozan all along. To me.
Yeah. For anyone who just recently started listening to this podcast, back in September, Sports Illustrated released the top 100 players in the NBA, and Ben ranked DeMar DeRozan 46th in the NBA.
Well,
which prompted
Rob Mahoney, but yeah, I took all the grief for it because I got death threats.
Right.
I got hate mail for months.
You really did get months of like consistent trolling from Raptors fans. And so this is a pretty solid victory lap for you, although
not at all. No, yeah. we're not at all. Let's save that for later in the series because they do still have a chance. I just am the biggest question of why he didn't show up very highly on this ranking. You could see it in this series because we had Chris Middleton over DeRozan, and that's really what angered them. The bottom line, if you're in a vacuum, you would rather have Chris Middleton right now than DeMar DeRozan because you can see how little effectiveness he can show in a series if he's got somebody who can lock him up. He doesn't have elite playmaking ability, can't stretch the court. Things get really tight when he's out there. It makes it harder for his teammates, a guy like Lowry. He's not an impact defensive player at all compared to a guy like Middleton. And all of those things kind of come back to bite you in the playoffs. And look no further than Giannis's post-game podium comments, right?
Oh, yeah. Hold on. we gotta pull up Giannis's post-game. Here we go.
DeRozan scored only 8 points and was just free throw. DeRozan scored only 8 points and was just free throw. DeRozan scored only 8 points and was just free throw.
The tone in Giannis's voice there is like if you load up your mobile banking app, you know, after kind of a bender of a weekend and you're like, ooh, I knew this was bad damage. I knew I spent a lot of money. I didn't know I spent that much. I mean, that's sort of like the vibe I got from
it. Was really
statements.
Great. It was really great. He's genuinely shocked and a little bit concerned.
Eight points.
I really, really want this to become a thing in the playoffs, by the way. Like, we need more stars reading opponent stat lines on the podium.
Well, there was also another box score moment after the Warriors just absolutely killed the Blazers in game two where Damian Lillard got up to leave the podium, but then he lingered And he was just like staring at the box score as if it was like an obituary. And he was just sort of like standing and he's all dressed up. I mean, clearly he's planned his outfit for months here for the playoffs. And then they just got smoked, run off the court. And he's just like staring down at the box score like, oh, my God, I can't believe it was this bad before he finally moved on. So the box scores, you know, we talked about the importance of the podium here during the playoffs and how it kind of shapes these stories. The box score, and I actually would say the water bottles they put on the podium sometimes, too. I mean, those are underrated props.
Props, yeah,
in this entire movie.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Keep the box scores on every podium. And look, with the Raptors, like, you mentioned it. I really can't explain what's happening here. Like, I understand the Bucks have length, but come on, man. I mean, Kyle Lowry, as I was watching that third quarter and fourth quarter, like, Lowry's firing up aimless threes. DeRozan, like you said, is just a zombie on the bench. I honest to God, I started wondering if it all goes back to like Vince Carter graduating from North Carolina on the same day as Game 7. Like maybe the basketball gods just haven't forgiven them, because there's a degree of this that just can't be explained. Like, I understand that the Raptors don't match up as well as you'd want to with the Bucks, but I mean, both of these guys have just fallen off a cliff.
Yeah, well, are you really that surprised? I mean, I think you've been leading the cheers for don't invest huge money this offseason in this core, right? I mean, hasn't that been your mantra here for a while? And I think Lowry's right in the middle of it. He's still a guy I would pay because, you know, he's going to consistently give you the potential to win 50 games every single season during the regular season. But if you want to list the reasons why you don't pay Kyle Lowry, it's because of his track record here over the last three postseasons as a lead guy. And the idea that even if he's in his prime, is he enough to take you over the top? I'm not saying that's my opinion, but I do think that's sort of what you've been hinting at, right?
Absolutely. Now, but it hasn't really been about Lowry. Like, I've been pro DeRozan on this podcast to sort of like balance out your scorching hot takes about him. But I mean,
I'm not scorching or hot. They're just accurate. Yeah,
clearly, we're seeing that now. All right. Fair enough. But what I've never really had that much confidence in DeRozan, because I watched Bradley Beal at 21 years old just completely show him up in the playoffs a few years ago. And I've just never really been a believer in him, never been a believer in Valanciunas. I do think that Kyle Lowry is really good and have always liked his game. And I mean, some of this is going to be tough to come back from. And like, you look at this series, I know you just said they should still pay Lowry, but you look at how dramatic this series, the drop-off has been, and you really got to kind of, it's going to be an interesting summer. That's all I can say. Like, you don't want to pay through the nose for a team that tops out at the second round at best.
Every once in a while, Nike or Jordan will come through with a retro that just makes me kind of like raise my eyebrows like, oh, do we really need to bring that back? That's kind of the feeling that I've had with a lot of the talk around DeRozan here, is everyone gets so excited. Oh, master of the mid-range. Oh, he's a throwback to a bygone era. Like, wow, look at these amazing, incredible, difficult shots he's hitting. That's cool for November. You know, it's cool for December. It might get you a player of the month honor. It's going to get you on the all-star team. I understand that. When it comes to April and May basketball, do you want to have the quote-unquote master of the mid-range who is going to have to deal with much more committed team defenses, much longer players in general, just better teams who are going to be able to key in on him and kind of force the ball out of his hands? Or would you rather have a player who can actually shoot the ball from beyond the arc, playing in a modern style, opening things up for his teammates and getting the offensive efficiency spiking? And to me, I would much rather have a guy on that wing who can just knock down a catch and shoot three-pointer, whose guy isn't going to collapse off of him because he just doesn't have that into his game, than someone who has this incredibly interesting and well-honed skill that just isn't that useful when it comes to team basketball when the stakes are high. That's been kind of my big point about him all along. And I think you're really seeing that here. I mean, even if he puts up, you know, a 40-point game like he showed multiple times during the regular season, the amount of possessions it takes for him to get there compared to some of these other guys is stark. And I even look at like Cleveland as a contrast, right? I mean, the ability for the Cavaliers to put guys like Deron Williams and Kyle Korver on the court and kind of get the whole being greater than the sum of the parts with LeBron's passing, you know, getting a lot of contributions out of those guys. I mean, it's just night and day to compare to what DeRozan's impact on his teammates is. You know what I mean? Like I you can have guys on the minimum who, as long as they can just shoot three pointers and keep a defender close to them, contributing to an incredible offensive attack and making it look so easy. Whereas you've got DeRozan on a max who is having his offense fall apart around him just because of that shooting ability. And that's why we had to kind of kill him in our top 100 rankings. It just shows through.
Well, the DeRozan stuff I get, the Lowry stuff I don't. But one more Giannis clip before we move on.
DeRozan scored only 8 points and was just free throw.
He's just the best. Hold on. And I also, we should be clear that the amount of trash talk that's happening, particularly from your end, but from all of our ends, from Giannis's end, like the Raptors are probably in good shape to go and steal game four now. So well, it is what it is.
I want to ask you though, I mean, was that a sneak diss or was he just like genuinely like, oh my God? Like when
I think it's a little bit of both. It's hard to say. It's hard to say. But we have one more Bucks question here.
Well, Jason, see, Giannis hides behind the nice guy, smoothie thing. But look, this is somebody who laid out Mike Dunleavy Jr. during the playoffs a couple years ago and is incredibly competitive given how much progress he's made in his game. I do wonder if
that's what's been fun about the playoffs is we're starting to see Giannis like get into sort of killer mode here. And it's, I mean, the whole East is on notice after these first few games.
Yeah, I just like the idea. Like, this is like Mr. Steal Your Girl territory where he puts up crazy lines and laughs at your line in the box score in the postgame press conference. This could be the Giannis that we need right now.
Okay, one more question on the Bucks. Jason asks, big fan of the show, started listening halfway through last year's playoffs. It never left the back of my mind, though, how hard the whole group went cracking jokes about Maker, his age, he's just a mixtape guy, etc. Listen back if you don't recall, it was bad. After seeing his development over the course of a season and getting some great moments in this series against the Raptors, any new thoughts? At least he's a great rim protector and a decent shooter. We also got another question wondering, I forget who it was from, wondering whether Brogdon and Thon would be the Milwaukee version of the Draymond Barnes draft. Again, I think that's a little bit over the top, but look,
let's
man.
Slow it down a little bit.
Can I, as the person who went harder than anyone on that Thon pick and gave that draft an F and briefly became the enemy of the Bucks Mafia online, let me first say that I was wrong. It's time to accept the loss because, first of all, the rest of that draft was horrible. So whatever, screw it. Gambling on Thon made sense in retrospect. But if you listen back to the draft night pod, I hated the Thon pick in large part because he was connected to Jeff Schwartz, Jason Kidd's agent, who also convinced them or influenced them or whatever to take Rashad Vaughn the year before over Bobby Portis. And draft night, I was just paranoid about bad Jeff Schwartz ideas wrecking Giannis's supporting cast. I think I might have even tweeted free Giannis that night. So it all was a little bit over the top. I was not a Thon believer, but look, Thon is really solid. He won't ever be a Giannis level player and maybe isn't a long-term starter, but he's been super impressive. And as a rotation player who drives other teams crazy, like he could be really helpful. I also found out after the draft that like that wasn't really a Jeff Schwartz thing, number one. And I also heard that the Hawks were pretty interested in Thon and the Spurs might have been interested in Thon. So like there were a number of smart teams who were paying attention to him as a rotation player who could do exactly what he's doing in this series.
Yeah, I think we can forgive you for going a little bit too far down the agent conspiracy rabbit hole. I mean, what I would just suggest going forward is like don't turn to, you know, InfoWars Sports for your pre-draft analysis. Just stick to Draft Express, you know, look at the players.
Right. Sure.
Not all the nonsense going on behind the scenes and you'll be fine. But isn't it a fascinating contrast between Thon and Jonas in this series? Because it's like, once again, Jonas
That's
is like kind of trying to find a spot, right? And he was somebody I had highlighted in some of my pre-playoffs analysis of like guys to watch. Like, how does Toronto make use of this guy? Is he on the way out? How useful can he be? and you'd almost rather have Fawn in this series, right? Like, isn't that, it's kind of weird.
It says a lot about just where the NBA is in general. And I mean, we've been over this a bunch of times this year, but it is pretty crazy to watch it play out where, like, there's just not much of a use for a decent big man like that. Whereas someone like Thon Maker, who can keep up with guys on the perimeter and knock down an open, like, 18-foot jump shot to space the floor, like, he's a super useful piece, even if there are elements of his game that are still, like, really basic and not where you'd want them to be. Size and length alone, like, he's an issue.
Yeah, well said. And then when you're looking forward to potentially the second round, right? Like, if you're trying to match up with Cleveland and they're showing that their best basketball happens when it's LeBron and shooters, they're spreading you out and they're just saying, screw it, let's get into a shootout. Who would you rather have in that scenario? Would you rather have Thon, who's shown he can at least cover some ground pretty well and isn't afraid to shoot from outside himself and has the length that you're mentioning? Or would you rather have Jonas, where the foot speed is always going to be an issue? Can he cover the territory? Can you just isolate him and really put him in tough situations where he's not able to get out and cover guys? I think, again, not only would you potentially rather have Thon in this head-to-head matchup in the first round, you'd probably rather have a guy like Thon in the second round. And to this questioner's point, that is not a development I saw a year ago from him. I mean, he just seemed a lot more raw. And so I think that's credit to Milwaukee for finding a good role for him. And again, credit to him for taking big strides. I am still a little bit just naturally hesitant because of that completely over the top profile we got of him earlier this season, where people were throwing out MVP talk. And, you know, Giannis was saying, like, Thon's farther along than I was at his age. All those things to me are like red flags. Like,
well, that's initially why I doubled down post draft and even earlier this year. People were like hitting me up on Twitter saying, look, they drafted Giannis. He's going to be it's already worked once. It's going to work again. And I'm like, look, Giannis and Thon are not in the same conversation, but
Giannis is a one in a billion guy. Yeah, I think that we really need to underscore that. I mean, Thon can be an incredible player, but Giannis is one of the craziest basketball stories we've ever seen in the history of the league.
And Brogdon, I've loved all along, so I'm all in on him as just a strangely effective second or third guard. And he's been great on defense too. But let's move on before we jinx the Bucks with too much optimism. Jonathan asks, will the Houston OKC series become an all-time confirmation bias game? No matter what you believe going in, no matter what happens in this series, people will use the same events as proof of their different beliefs. Russ is the MVP. Harden's the MVP. Rockets have a better team than OKC. Russ is the only thing keeping OKC in these games, et cetera, et cetera. What do you think, man?
Yeah, I really don't want to get back down into this MVP conversation because it's just... it's just exhausting. But what?
All right. Well, then let me take it.
Well, okay. Hold on one second, though, real quick, and tell me if this is something you agree with or not.
Okay.
I do have a concern here that even putting aside the MVP talk, we're having the same conversation about Russell in the playoffs that we've had for the last 5 or 6 years. It might be louder. It might be a little bit more intense because he doesn't have someone to kind of share the scrutiny with in Kevin Durant. But it's the same fundamental question in terms of, is he playing the right way? Does this style have a ceiling? And I don't even call it hero ball, what he's doing. I'm now calling it martyr ball, because hero ball essentially has this like underlying assumption that it could actually work and you could be the hero.
Yeah.
I don't see any possible way where Russell plays in this manner, where he sets records for usage and shots attempts in postseason game, where he comes out as the hero. Like, it's doomed to failure. So he's playing martyr ball. And I think even that conversation, it's just exhausting because we've had this, you know, the last five, six postseasons, we've had it.
Yeah, that's a really good audible from you. I really like martyr ball for Russ. That game, that fourth quarter was the first time I really regretted my MVP vote. And
whoa. Are you serious?
No, let me be clear about this. It's not because Russ's season didn't deserve the MVP. I still think he was the MVP of this season. He absolutely deserved it, and it will make sense. But having voted for him, I had trouble because I couldn't pile on during that fourth quarter. But man, I mean, everything we talked about earlier in this season, all of it was right there. That fourth quarter is everything that makes Westbrook so frustrating and probably a little bit overrated next to the rest of the league. Like you said, man, we've seen him have that playoff game during every playoff run since the Thunder started making the playoffs. That fourth quarters like that are why KD left. And I just don't know if he's capable of playing a different way. But like, I watched that, and if nothing else, you can look at the three Thunder superstars, Durant, Harden, and Russ, and say, man, like, somehow OKC kept the worst star. And that's not entirely Presti's fault or anyone's fault, but it just really did not work out for them. So
yeah,
it's not an indictment of Russ's regular season, because everything he did all year remains incredible, but it's almost heartening to see that like everyone is now having to reckon with the fact that like there are real limits to his game, especially as you get into the playoffs against good teams.
Yeah, the thing that had me going down that, you know, it's deja vu all over again path was actually his post-game press conference, where he said, hey, I don't give a bleep about my stat line. We lost. And I kind of felt like I've heard him say that exact same thing with or without that profanity like 30 times over the course of his career. And then I started thinking, you know, if you gave me a time machine and fast forwarded to 2019, 2020, is it likely that he would be saying those exact same words in the exact same manner after another playoff loss? And I think there's a very high possibility that we would be right there too. And I'm not trying to say that Westbrook has not evolved as a player. He has definitely evolved as a player. I mean, you compare rookie Russ, or, you know, first couple years Russ, to where he is now. There's no question.
He's a much
better all around player.
He has. And we saw that in the first three quarters of game two, but his low moments are remarkably similar if you look across the course of his career.
Yeah, I guess my point is his blind spot remains intact. Like, you know, his Achilles heel in terms of the unwavering self-belief and the tendency to always call his own number in tough situations to the detriment of the team concept at times has always been an issue, and it's still there. Yeah. And you know, I can't say I'm super surprised that this series has played out through two games how it has, but we shouldn't count them out either. I mean, they're going to have a fun home court advantage there in Oklahoma City, and I think that's true of some other teams as well. Even they're going back for game three, like Utah, for example. I think the atmosphere actually could start to shape these series in ways maybe we don't expect.
Yeah, I mean, the way I look at Russ is he really is this generation's Iverson, and is polarizing in a lot of the same ways and sort of magnetic for younger fans in a lot of the same ways. And in the same way that, like, I think back to Iverson's MVP year, like, he was so incredible carrying that Sixers team that he deserved the credit. But even then, I don't think anyone, if you went across the league in 2001, nobody's taking Iverson over Kobe. You know, and there's nobody would take Russ over five or six other guys in the league right now.
Yeah, I mean, this kind of goes back to my psychoanalysis of the media voters, where it's much more natural for a media voter to want to identify with Russ's struggle against the odds and, you know, being the little guy than it is like the machine of a Cleveland offense, or the steadiness of the San Antonio Spurs approach, or how easy Golden State makes it look. I mean, people want to identify with guys like Westbrook and Iverson on a very basic level, because they see themselves in that guy. A lot of people do.
All right. For the record, that wasn't me. And I don't regret my MVP vote, like, in a broader sense. I just did during that fourth quarter because I couldn't talk shit on Twitter.
Guess what? I have not regretted my MVP vote once during the postseason, and I really strongly believe I never will. And I just want the record to state that.
I am not going to regret mine as soon as I can go back to freely talking shit about Russ. But he was incredible this year, and I'm not saying that because I identify with the underdog. I think down the stretch it was a tied race, and he broke the tie. And he deserves credit for that.
Don't you think the reason why a lot of people do identify with Westbrook, and like, they're part of the Westbrook hive, as you've called it, and Iverson's got one of the biggest hives, I think, in NBA history, is for that reason, though, right?
Yeah, sure. I mean, he's kind of like a countercultural hero and should be and is great in that role. The only time it gets weird though is when like there was a stretch this year where it was just consensus that he was incredible and nobody was really criticizing the way he played, and that to me took it too far. And now I think you're starting to see a more balanced Westbrook conversation. Like, yes, he's amazing, but no, this is not like the best way for teams to win. So anyways.
Yeah, well, I think the reason for that is during the regular season, they were pretty much maxing out in terms of their ceiling, right? Because of the way he was playing in clutch scenarios, because he had perfect health, because he was putting up these insane numbers, they were reaching their ceiling, which wasn't that high, and people didn't have huge expectations for them. The conversation shifts in the postseason where everybody has the same ceiling. That's winning a title. And once you can start to see that Oklahoma City really has no shot at even being in that conversation, that's where, you know, the nitpicking starts to come in.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's move on. John says, hey, guys, love the show. Paul George is likely leaving Indiana next summer, and the Kevin Love trade rumors never really disappear. Do you think that a swap of all-stars between the Cavs and Pacers would help both teams? And, you know, these are the Paul George rumors we need. Someone else also hit us up about Paul George on the Wolves next year. That's what I want to hear. Dream big, people, okay? We don't have to limit ourselves to Paul George to the Celtics rumors. Rule nothing out. Also, because if the Cavs do advance to the finals and truly like get blown out by the Warriors, Love is definitely expendable. So, I mean, it's a possibility. And Paul George playing next to LeBron and Kyrie would be incredible. And he's a much better fit for a Cavs team that's going after the Warriors the next few years.
It was an interesting thought experiment here, because let's say you do put Kevin Love on the Pacers. I think you get pretty excited about the offensive potential of Love and Turner, because you could really have good spacing.
Yeah,
that
that's
line.
A good point.
But the downside is, can Love be a number one guy in this modern NBA? Or have we kind of seen enough of a shift from when he was sort of at a statistical peak in Minnesota with style of play and how things are going offensively, where you couldn't be a true contender if he's your number one player? You know,
yeah.
I would say I had more faith in him as the main guy 5 years ago than I do now, even though we know his stats would balloon if he was given a larger role because he's kind of taken a step back in Cleveland. I don't know. I think if you're Indiana, you'd rather have Love for years on his contract than, you know, the threat of Paul George and, like, you know, his last year walking for nothing. So you'd have to consider something like that. But I don't know what's the ceiling of that Indiana team.
Well, let me ask you, what about the Wolves idea? Because if the Wolves, let's say they land like the sixth pick and then throw in Wiggins and six for Paul George, it would be a big, big, big risk on Minnesota's part, because there's no guarantee that Paul George wants to spend the next 5 years in Minneapolis. And he's a free agent after next season. But I mean, that's probably the best deal the Pacers would get, right?
Well, that is similar to what happened with Boogie, where a team that has a ton of trouble, you know, landing talent or acquiring talent just kind of takes this huge risk of bringing in a guy who may or may not stay long term.
Yeah,
I don't think Minnesota has reached that same level of desperation yet. You know, Towns is still kind of becoming the player we expect him to become. It's not like where Anthony Davis was sort of stuck in a treadmill there for a few years. So I guess I would be surprised if Minnesota sold out and kind of exposed itself to all of that risk when, you know, Wiggins still has the potential to be, what, like 80%, 85% of Paul George over the next 5 years, and he's had great health. I mean, that to me is kind of a sort of a last resort type of trade where it's like,
Whoa. It's not. I mean, if you could get Wiggins for George straight up, I think you make that deal, don't you?
I see what you're saying, but like the risk of saying, look, we're going to take on this superstar and just pray that he resigns with us.
Yeah.
And we have no reason to believe he would want to resign in Minnesota. I mean, how often do guys, you know, big name players like willingly go there and willingly re-up? I mean, it doesn't really happen. So that is a riskier move than it looks on paper. Just this idea of, oh, wow, we can take a developing star wing and turn him into a legit star wing, and we're going to go forward with that. I mean, it's not quite that simple in this scenario.
Okay. Well, keep sending us Paul George ideas. Any idea is welcome except Paul George Celtics trades.
Because like in New Orleans, their whole thing was, we can lean on Boogie. He's got a friend here with Anthony Davis, and there's like a regional tie where he's kind of from the area. There's a chance he just resigns.
Well, New Orleans was not giving up anything, so it didn't really matter. I mean, they were giving up maybe a first round pick and maybe and Buddy Hield. Like, it was a smart gamble. This would be more of a gamble on Minnesota's part, so it's a little scarier. But
yeah, so I guess in this scenario, it's like Chris Dunn in a pick, right? And if you're
sure.
That's
a deal you make.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. And that's a much different equation. That's where the hesitancy comes in, is like you're kind of passing on a locked in asset you know you're going to be able to keep, because Wiggins is going to, you know, be there for the foreseeable future. That's just a lot of risk, because he can leave next summer, you know, for the Lakers or the Celtics or whoever else. And then you're just stuck like, wow, what do? We just kind of cleaned out our asset trove for 1 year of Paul George. That really went great.
Well, speaking of the Celtics, though, we should talk about this series, man. I mean, we were reluctant to bury Boston on Tuesday when we recorded, but it now is looking pretty dicey. Rondo's hurt. Jay Roman asks, should the Bulls do anything possible to get all their playoff games aired on TNT? And should we never take gambling advice from Andrew?
This is what I mean. These people are just taking shots. It's not even, no, like, this is my job, guys.
I completely, completely deserve it for writing off the Bulls. I'm certainly not alone in writing off the Bulls, but I did not see this coming at all. And you did. So tell me what you've seen so far.
Well, I don't even, again, I'm hesitant to do this victory lap thing, because this Rondo thing throws the whole series up in the air. And I never thought I would say that. I mean, I've been a noted staunch Rondo critic for years, crushed him throughout the Sacramento era, crushed him at the end of the Dallas. You know, that ended so poorly. And he was just approaching career reclamation, wasn't he? I mean, he had almost gotten his name back. Like this, he was in the process of the unthinkable, getting his name back.
And you know what? Thus far, my favorite part of this series had been since you backed the Bulls, it forced you to root for Rajon Rondo, who is maybe your least favorite basketball player in the entire league for the past few years. So that really was like a silver lining to being dead wrong about the Bulls for me.
Yeah. And now, I mean, his absence really weighs here. And I was expecting this to be a situation where they go back home. I mean, sweep was in play. And it's going to be, I mean, as crazy as that sounds, it was. I mean, and not just because of how well Chicago was playing, but I think, I mean, the emotional toll of the Isaiah Thomas situation off the court definitely seems to be weighing on the Celtics. And then just their struggles to generate anything from their role guys. And now those guys have to go on the road and perform. I mean, that always gets me a little bit nervous. But I think it's going to make Isaiah's life easier. I think it's going to probably require more defensively from Jimmy. I mean, if I were them, I'd start to really think about just locking Jimmy onto Isaiah. It's going to require you know, guys like Wade to step up and do more offensively too, because Rondo has been a solid facilitator. I mean, he's really sneaked some points out for guys in this series with his passing ability, which was kind of always there. Sometimes it was questionably effective, but in this series it was effective. So I don't know. I'm throwing my hands up on this one, because
you know what's great is that everyone around the league is throwing their hands up on this one. I talked to somebody from an NBA team yesterday, and they were like, yeah, like the Bulls are looking great. And I was like, isn't this incredible? And then they responded by saying, yeah, it would not surprise me in the slightest if they went up 3-0 and lost the series. Because that's how this series, that's how this whole year has been for them. And it is what it is. But in light of the Rondo news, I was thinking about it while we were waiting to go on here. And honestly, this Bulls team, I'm trying to contextualize it, and I keep coming back to this. I've thought about it a couple times through the first two games. This Bulls team reminds me of the Trump campaign.
Uh-oh.
They were counted out from the beginning. They have been full of backstabbing and, like, off-the-record sources throughout. they were supposed to implode like five different times when just like unforgivable shit hit the media, and nothing can kill them. Okay. Like no matter what, nothing kills this Bulls team. That's why I'm not worried about the Rondo injury. So, I mean, we'll see how it plays out.
I'm just getting pictures of like Gar Pax contracting WikiLeaks to hack the Celtics like database or something.
I mean, I went through it, honestly. Hoiberg is Reince Priebus, I think.
Oh, God.
Wade has got to be Steve Bannon. Jimmy Butler, I don't know who Jimmy Butler is. Rondo is Kellyanne Conway. And then Reinsdorf is definitely Donald Trump, complete with his sons running day-to-day operations for the Bulls.
Is Jimmy Ivanka?
Yes! Jimmy is Ivanka, thank you! Jimmy is the one person people can't totally hate.
Exactly. Well, that's phenomenal work, again. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, do you have a read for this series? If you had to pick it right now, are you on the Bulls blow it because of this Rondo thing?
I mean, I'm going to stick with picking the Celtics in part because I'm trying to jinx the Celtics. I don't want to play the Celtics in the second round with the Wizards. So I'm going to continue picking them and we can see what happens. But I will say that like, this Bulls team has really won me over. It is so stupid and inexplicable that they are suddenly turning it on for the playoffs. And they could win the next three series, and I would still be convinced that the entire team is just garbage beyond Jimmy Butler. But that's kind of what makes this fun. So I'm really enjoying this run.
Yeah, I feel you. Just quick note on Marcus Smart. Flipping the fans off during a game two at home?
Well, hold on. We have Celtics talk here. CJ asks, with the Celtics prime for a first round exit, can we please get a Golliver victory lap over them totally sitting out the trade deadline? Do you think that management will stomach an upset more easily given that they got the first seed and still have a hoard of assets? Blah, blah, blah. What do you think about Ainge through all this?
I mean, you know what I think about Ainge. This was one of the all-time greatest competitors. In Oregon, he is viewed as a legend. The best all-around athlete in the state's history. Played three sports. Was drafted into Major League Baseball. He's famously had these me against the world quotes when he came back as a member of the Blazers, where it became clear nobody believes in us. And he was kind of way out in front on that mentality of, you know, the bunker. And, you know, the media, all that stuff that has become just sort of cliche in this modern media environment, Ainge was like preaching hard in the early 90s. And for a competitor like him to either A, believe way too much in the team that he had pulled together, that he was just ready to ride it out, which I don't really believe that was his conclusion, but that's one possibility is, oh, we're just such a great team, we don't need any help. Or B, completely have no faith in his team to win a title this season, which seems like the more reasonable conclusion he reached back in February. It was just like, look, we're a pretty cute story, but we've got some flaws. We probably can't keep up with the Warriors this year, so let's just punt and play for another day.
Yeah,
and maybe can't keep up with the Cavaliers too. I just feel like it's out of character, and that's why I'm so disappointed, because this was a team that if everything had broken correctly, if he had made some targeted additions to this rotation, they should be handling this first round series much more easily. They should be looking at a series potentially, you know, with Washington, where, you know, Washington's shown when its starters are not on the court, that's a vulnerable team. Are you going to run Wall and Beal into the high 40s in that series? Or, you know, I don't think that they're like some unstoppable juggernaut. This is a team that should be getting ready right now to ramp up and talk itself into making the finals because Cleveland can't play any defense, right? And instead, it's the biggest disappointment in the entire postseason, with the Raptors as a very close second, depending on how that series shakes out. So I'm just disappointed in Danny the competitor. Like, I thought he would have gone for it a little bit. That's all
I'm disappointed
saying.
In Danny the Oregonian.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Because I know he's better than this. This guy played his butt off in the NBA.
Yeah.
You know, for more than a decade. He was a key contributor to all sorts of Suns teams. Remember the Suns teams? I mean, Danny was in the Suns teams. He was part of the Rip City Blazers. He was part of the Celtics, obviously. I mean, he had an unbelievable career. And to just let the season pass them by, I just don't get it.
I think Ainge was also like great at several different sports.
That's what I said. I mean, he was drafted in Major League Baseball. He's the best all-around athlete. If you ask the old head sports writers in Oregon, they will say Ainge is the best athlete to ever come out of the state.
Yeah, and yeah.
Because of his competitive spirit. Where was it in February? Masai competed. Even Ernie Grunfeld competed.
Can I tell you what disappoints me?
Please.
So it bugs me that I'm seeing a bunch of different Celtics fans on Twitter now turn around and say that Paul George and Jimmy Butler were never actually available at the trade deadline. Because that, to me, just doesn't ring true at all. And I've talked to people about it. I've heard different things. But Jimmy was available. You can convince me that the Pacers were never really talking about a Paul George trade. But like the Bulls called the Celtics about Jimmy Butler last year. They called them before the trade deadline. They called them in June. Like, they've always been talking about a Jimmy Butler trade. So don't pretend like this wasn't a choice. Like, Danny Ainge chose not to give up Jay Crowder and Jaylen Brown and the Nets pick for Jimmy Butler. And maybe he could have gotten him for less. Maybe he could have thrown in Marcus Smart instead of Jaylen. Or maybe he could have thrown in... that's probably it. They probably would not have taken Terry Rozier. But like, it was a choice to keep this core intact and try to win and then also keep that Nets pick. And it may pay off. Like, it's too early to say because the lottery hasn't happened yet. Like, that we probably won't know for 3 or 4 years whether the Celtics were smart at the deadline or not. But it really bugs me that now people are trying to sort of like rewrite history a little bit. And it's happened, like Celtics blog, Simmons has jumped in, like a bunch of different people are saying, look, like we don't really know what was available at the trade deadline. But like, we do kind of know that Jimmy was the Bulls were open to trading Jimmy and the Celtics just didn't want to pay for it. And that's fine. But And maybe it's even reasonable because they weren't going to beat the Warriors this year or maybe next year with Jimmy Butler and Isaiah Thomas. So if the defense for not making that deal is that they weren't going to win the title, totally cool. But don't pretend that that deal was not a real thing.
Yeah, it's awful early in the playoffs to be kind of circling the wagons, isn't it? I mean, that's a red flag by itself. Like, if it's halftime of game two and you're already coming up with the laundry list of excuses for your GM's inactivity, guess what? You played yourself.
Well, and that's like, that's half of what makes this series so interesting. So, it lean into it, you know? It's been wild to watch Jimmy Butler, like, almost single-handedly at times, just dominate this Celtics team.
Well, look, in defense of the Celtics fans and their observers, I mean, it is a shell shock scenario when Brad Stevens is just getting slandered on Twitter for like a week straight. And I would probably start just screaming out things, whether or not I believe them about the trade deadline. And Danny, if, you know, my deity in Brad Stevens was under merciless attack because he's losing to Fred Hoiberg in a postseason series.
Yeah.
So I think there's some level of just like utter panic here. And
totally. So, all right, well, let's move on. Rory says, I was wondering who you guys thought was the second best NBA player in the East. Really quickly, at this point, I think you got to give it to Giannis.
Yeah. So far during the postseason, I think so. I think my group of candidates would include Giannis, Jimmy Butler, Paul George, John Wall in some order.
Yeah. And it's really close. It's pretty crazy because none of those guys were necessarily in the mix at the beginning of the season, but they are all. Paul George probably would have been the choice back in October, but it's
notable
now
exclusions:
pretty heated.
Isaiah Thomas, Kyle Lowry, DeMar DeRozan, not in the discussion,
and Kyrie not in the discussion.
Kyrie definitely not in the discussion.
Rapetzel asks, female listener, she asks, are you guys ready to change your defensive player of the year pick after that Draymond game and how stout Utah's defense has looked even without Gobert? I'm not ready, but again, and we said this on the awards podcast, I'll be pretty happy if Draymond wins regardless.
So this was a great question that I knew was coming. Again, it's based on an 82 game sample size, right? So what happens in the postseason is not really going to affect my feelings about my vote. It will affect my opinion of players, you know, kind of going forward, you know, with their reputations. But we also got another question from somebody who was upset that Paul George wasn't in our discussion of all NBA guys and Draymond was. Like, we just kind of automatically granted Draymond the all NBA nod when we were doing our awards podcast.
Right.
I hope people get reminded again, and I don't understand how this hasn't gotten through to people, about just how good he is. I mean, his impact defensively so far against Portland has been incredible, especially down the stretch of game one. And he's an underrated offensive player too. I mean, people love to look at the 3-point shooting numbers and just, you know, his raw point total and say he's not really doing a lot. His assist numbers are always through the roof. He's a key facilitator for them. He helps make Curry much better. He does get the respect from defenses, so he creates space because teams generally track him. He's capable of hitting the 3-pointer and has done so, you know, throughout Golden State's run here. And bottom line, his plus-minus numbers and his impact numbers are completely off the charts, and this team is not winning 67-plus games for 3 years in a row by accident. And it's not all Steph Curry. Draymond is really, really, really good. So that doesn't necessarily mean I think he deserves to, you know, have us say we snubbed him. I think Rudy Gobert's 82-game body of work still speaks for itself. I thought him going down on the first play of game one was one of the saddest twists, you know, the cruelest twists I've seen in a long time, especially in person, because they were, you know, like he was their rock the whole season long, and to have him just, you know, plucked from that series right off the top was sad. But to me, if you feel like Draymond was the defensive player of the year, you've already had enough to make yourself feel good about that through two games of the postseason.
Yeah. Just to add to that, it's not only that Draymond is really good, but he's just so unfair in terms of what he allows the Warriors to do. Like, his ability to cover three or four different positions, stretch the floor on offense. Like, he's just such a unique piece in the NBA. And like, there's just nobody really like him. I guess LeBron can play like him sometimes, but doesn't really like to. Kawhi could maybe play a similar role. Giannis could get there, but he's just a freak, man. And then the other thing is, the one guy who could really shut him down and who really gave him issues was Kevin Durant. And now Kevin Durant's on the Warriors, recruited by Draymond. So he gets bonus points for that too. It's wild. Like,
and one of the reasons why I get so upset at Draymond when he has situations like the suspensions last year or the flagrants is because on a pure basketball IQ level, he's one of the smartest players I've ever seen in my entire life. And people that will fly in the face of the stereotypes people have of, like, you know, he can't control his emotions, he does stupid things, he blew last year's finals. Play to play, even within plays, I mean, second to second defensively, his recognition, his instincts are off the charts. And understanding how to play the right way, make his teammates better offensively, it's just ingrained. You have it or you don't have it. And you're kind of making the comparison like, oh, Kawhi could kind of do what he does. Offensively, Kawhi can't. I mean, he can't play make for his teammates as well as Draymond can. And that's not a knock on Kawhi. They're just different players. Draymond can't score like Kawhi. But his gift in terms of facilitating offense, it's a very short list. And it's not quite there with, like, Chris Paul, LeBron James, but it's not very far behind those guys.
Yeah, well, and it's also, I wrote about this on Monday, it's not just that he has, like, some crazy motor. Draymond also has a 7'1 or 7'2 wingspan. So he really is a freak. It's not like he's just all heart. So it's, again, the Warriors are unfair. But next question here. Opposite coast, Colin McCarthy asks, I know Golliver bought John Wall stock in May 09 when it was at its lowest. Smart move. And Sharp represents the Washington faithful with the best of them. So it may sound crazy, but should you be giving Wall even more love? He looks like a man on a mission. With the Cavs D looking kind of blah, the Celtics, Lowry, DeRozan continuing to build on their playoff brick mansion. Are the Wiz poised to take the East? I know it's early. I'm just saying. So as far as Wall love is concerned, like, here's where I am with Wall. He is so good right now. He's turned up to 11, and this Wizards team is fucking awesome. And I don't care if anyone else realizes it. Like, honestly, I'm kind of enjoying flying under the radar a little bit. I have no desire to talk about how great Wall is, because every time buzz like this starts on the internet, it can get kind of annoying. Like Kendrick Lamar. Like, Kendrick Lamar is cool, but then it becomes, oh my God, Kendrick Lamar is the best rapper ever. And then there's like a whole backlash of people who are like, Kendrick's not actually that great. And it all just turns into like a stupid discussion. So I'm glad that no one is having these arguments about Wall. I don't even care. Like, John Wall is for me right now. It doesn't matter if anyone pays attention to the Wizards, because Wall is the shit. This team is fun. Like, they're non-ironically comparing themselves to Death Row Records in 1996. I could not be more in on what's happening in DC.
I loved all of that. Strong. But I also know there's another side of you that wants to dip into that water and say, look, if you have to start a team right now, you'd rather have John Wall than Russell Westbrook.
Oh, yes. And that's not even like it shouldn't be as controversial a take as I guess it is. But again, right now I'm in playoff mode, not even going to have those arguments. People could just be wrong.
No. Slow down. Westbrook is the guy you called the MVP this season.
Yes.
You've backed him down the stretch. But you're saying not only take off the A-list guys that we always talk about, Durant, LeBron, Kawhi, Harden, you're saying you actually would take John Wall to start a franchise over Westbrook, which now bumps him down to what, like 6th or 7th on the pecking order. You're going to have to explain that one.
No, I don't have to explain it. My whole point is that I'm right. I know I'm right. People who watch John Wall on a regular basis know I'm right. And it doesn't matter what anyone else thinks. Okay. So, and Westbrook won MVP because he started this season looking to be so ridiculous that he would win MVP, and he succeeded. Okay. He just pushed everything to a level of absurdity that forced the world to acknowledge him. Congrats. If you're trying to actually win a title, John Wall is the choice. That's all I can say.
Wow.
And we're not. Oh. And I'm also not going to talk about what the Wizards can or can't do in the East. But look, Colin McCarthy is not wrong. It's opening up a little bit.
I think Cleveland's still in complete command. And I know their game 3 against Indiana was like the ultimate open floor experiment, because the first half was their defense was trash, the Andrew Sharp take, and these guys are doomed and like they are much more vulnerable. Their second half was my take, which is their offense is unstoppable. They can get away with it against the East until they run into Golden State, who's going to make them pay
for slow starts. Point out though that the Pacers are a terrible basketball team.
Well, the Wizards aren't that much better.
No, the Wizards are a lot better, a lot harder to guard. You don't get points for suddenly flipping the switch and guarding Monte Ellis and Thad Young and Miles Turner. I'm sorry. That doesn't count as a playoff triumph.
You get points for scoring 70 points in the second half, with all of the points coming on three-pointers, layups, and free throws for the entire team, except when Channing Frye stepped his foot on the three-point line once for a long two. Okay, it's a very intelligently designed offense. It has a much higher ceiling than what Washington can put out there.
All right,
Washington is very good. I understand that Indiana is not there, right. But there's a gap there. But I would say the gap between Cleveland and everybody else is arguably bigger than the gap between Washington and Indiana.
Look, I'm not going to sit here and say that the Wizards can beat the Cavs. You're not going to force me to do that. All I am saying is that the warning signs of the Cavs are real. Like, anytime a team is publicly talking about flipping the switch, historically, that has not been a good sign. So it is what it is. And I'm not going to be impressed, but we're not going to really learn anything from this Pacers series, because the Pacers are too crappy to actually push them. And we knew that coming in.
Yeah, I think we've learned a little bit just about their ability to get towards where they want to be offensively. I mean, right now their offense efficiency, you know, through 2 or 3 games, obviously it's small sample. It's better than Houston's, better than Golden State's, and both those teams have played pretty well offensively. So they're leading the league right now on offense in the postseason. That is a good sign. That was no guarantee, because we never quite know what's going to come from Kyrie. You know, he sat out the fourth quarter basically in game three because they had it rolling with other guys. So I think we've seen some positive things for Cleveland. If I'm a Cavaliers fan, I'm feeling better now than I did last week.
Okay. Fair enough. A couple more questions here, and then we have some nonsense questions at the end. So let's see. Luca from Croatia. Do you guys feel that Chris Paul is a Hall of Famer, considering the fact that he's never played in a conference finals? Yes, obviously. He's been awesome. I will go on that rant on another day. What do you think would be the best move for him in free agency? So this is where the new CBA really kind of screws things up, because the best move for any human is to sign a $200 million contract when it's offered to you. But man, it would be so much more fun to see him go to San Antonio or something, you know?
Yeah, I just don't see any real reason for buzz around him leaving. I mean, he's a family guy. Everybody's settled. Big market. I mean, he's got kind of what you would want. And I think the more likely scenario is he just turns into this recruiter in chief, where he gets paid out of his mind on this huge contract like you're talking about. And then it's either try to lure Melo, which at this point, maybe not that hard.
Yeah.
Or, you know, you try to maybe pick up D-Wade off the scrap heap at some point. You know, I'm not sure how his last chapter is really going to go in LA, but I'm very confident he's going to still be there.
Yeah, it's just too much money to leave behind. Two Spurs questions from Flo Biden, who says, watching the Spurs slowly pick the Grizz apart, and by the end of game two, I realized Kawhi has 37 and 11 on 14 shots. Is it realistic to assume that Kawhi could somehow get better than he already is? Does this guy even have a ceiling? And then Herm Flappington asks, can we all take a moment and reflect that the Spurs were a blown Corey Joseph pick away from both Kawhi and Jimmy Butler on the same team? They're the list of Kawhi hypotheticals throughout NBA internet history is shockingly long. Whether it's putting Kawhi on a different team or putting a different draft pick next to Kawhi. And I also want to commend both Flo Biden and Herm Flappington for having great question names. but yeah, as far as Kawhi, he's already so far beyond what I would have expected. Even you could have shown me Kawhi finals MVP version of Kawhi, and I never would have imagined him taking over the way he has.
The Jimmy one is not a hypothetical I'd ever thought of. I mean, that's pretty insane. And just imagine if those two guys were going at each other in practice every single day. They'd probably be workout buddies during the offseason too. I mean,
They're
two of the most improved players since they arrived in the NBA, two of the biggest competitors in the league.
And Jimmy's
imagine
from
if they
Texas,
were pushing
man.
Each other. Yeah, I know. Imagine if they were pushing each other. That is the crazy part.
Yeah.
That's too bad we missed out on that. You know, somebody else had an interesting question about the Spurs not too long ago. Apologies for not remembering who it was. They wanted to know, what would Westbrook look like if he had been in the Pop, you know, philosophy the whole way up? Like, if the Spurs had drafted him, what does he look like now? Have you ever given that any thought?
Yes, it's a popular question, again, on the NBA internet. And for me, I think the Spurs would have gotten the best out of him and would have sort of molded him a little bit differently than OKC did. Personally, I think it's more interesting to imagine if you put Westbrook on the Spurs now, what happens? Does he and Pop just kill each other? Does he adapt to Pop and team up with Kawhi? Because Kawhi would theoretically be a perfect player to pair with him. But I don't know. I mean, it might just be a disaster throwing him in that organization.
I think if he had come up all the way from, you know, coming out of college straight to the Spurs, I think the kind of junk three-pointers that he sometimes gets credit for hitting, because, oh, what a crazy tough shot. He just pulled up and banged it home from 35 feet. Those would all have been eliminated from his game probably by the end of the second year, because Pop would have just benched him.
Exactly. I
mean, he would have just put him on the bench, man. And say, good luck. I think you'd also see him doing more Tony Parker-like stuff where it's either it's attack or then give up the ball and then re-attack. I think you'd see more of that. And I think they use him as a secondary playmaker more often, where somebody else is bringing the ball up. You run this action, boom, swing it to Westbrook, and now he's attacking you instead of, from the top of the key down, he's attacking the side, or he's getting into side pick and rolls with guys where maybe it's a more advantageous situation so he can have a, you know, a better chance at finishing. I mean, the difference between Tony Parker's like sort of elegant finishing and Westbrook's brute force finishing, you know, you wouldn't expect Parker to be like such a better guy around the basket than Westbrook if you just looked at those two guys side by side physically. So there'd probably be some room for him to improve as a finisher. But I think, yeah, I mean, it all comes down to the willingness to adapt, you know, mentally. And I think Westbrook is enough of a competitor that he could have been brainwashed by Pop. Like, I think he could have bought in.
Yeah.
If you're saying, if you drop him in there right now, I think it might be too late.
I think so too. But I think it might be too late, but it might be a lot more entertaining. So take that for what it's worth.
You just root for the car crashes.
Yeah. Derek Barton asks, if you could take one player from a non-playoff team and add them to a current playoff team to take down the Warriors, what move do you make?
What's your call?
Well, I think you got to go with Anthony Davis because he's one of the only guys who could like realistically counter a lot of what the Warriors do. But I'm not sure which team you would put him on. Like maybe Houston? I don't know.
I was going to say San Antonio. I mean, I still think San Antonio is the biggest threat to Golden State.
Yeah.
That's kind of a weird fit with Anthony Davis. But I do think maybe if you had a front line of Davis and Aldridge and Kawhi, I mean, that is a pretty ridiculous front line. I mean, you're playing the like zig when everybody else zag game
with
those guys, but maybe that would just throw them for a loop and kind of force Golden State to match up to San Antonio rather than vice versa. So that'd probably be where I started, but I don't know. I'm going to go back to this kind of patented take, which is Golden State's a lot better than everybody else. You know, the gap is huge. I mean, they smoked Portland without Kevin Durant. You're sitting there thinking like, well, how long could they rest him for? You know, because like halfway through that game, it was like, well, they don't need to bring Durant back for game three. They're going to be fine. And it's like, well, when do they need to bring him back? The Western Conference Finals? I mean, should he just chill for a month? Like, put him on sabbatical?
Can we get Anthony Davis on the Wiz? Maybe shake things up a little bit?
Yeah, you guys might be able to win the East if you had Anthony Davis.
God, you're the worst. All right. So we're done talking playoffs right now. We just have some extra questions and corrections from prior episodes. So feel free to turn off the pod if you want.
Let's pitch this a little better, Andrew. Don't turn off the pod, first of all. This is like the mullet portion of the podcast, all right? We're calling it overtime. We've got some funny questions and follow-ups. This is from the openfloormail@gmail.com. Mailbox. So continue to send those questions in. Let's get into like the inside joke section of this podcast because we have a lot of these and we've got some very dedicated listeners who clearly are tracking our inside jokes as we go.
Okay. Well, Trevor wanted you to follow up on Ryan McDonough's vote of confidence in Phoenix.
Woof, right? It's tricky because it feels like they're going to be next summer where Orlando is this summer, where if they have another disappointing year where they just can't win at all, the young guys don't make as much progress towards, you know, really getting a leg up in the standings. And somebody like Eric Bledsoe just sort of gets tired of all the losing and maybe starts to chirp a little bit next year.
Right.
Where they're probably going to have to change directions next summer. So that leads to the inevitable question of like, why not just do it this summer? Like if you can already see that happening, why not try to go a different direction? I'm not sure he's made like a capital punishment type mistake recently.
Capital punishment type mistake.
No, what? You know what I mean though? Like there's not this, he didn't put his whiteboard on the internet.
Yes.
After look, the All-Star break.
No, the capital punishment mistake from Ryan McDonough was the Isaiah Thomas, Goran Dragic situation like 4 years ago.
Yeah, and that's different than leaking your entire draft board like 2 weeks before you get fired. So
yeah, that's true.
It's a slightly different situation, but I feel for Suns fans because this is a huge summer and do they have faith and confidence in this front office that has, you know, struck out or misplayed its hands multiple times over the course of the last few years. You know, I wouldn't, if I were them, I'd be very skeptical. So that's my take. Prove it, Ryan.
Yes. Ben Golliver is thinking of you, Phoenix. Can we talk about your Kendrick Lamar tweet for 1 second? Because I've been thinking about it for almost 12 hours.
Bring it on. Let's hear it.
All right, so you tweeted out LeBron talking about Kendrick Lamar last night. I immediately attacked you for shamelessly chasing millennial retweets. And your stated justification for the Kendrick tweet was, never heard him sing before, but the World Wide Web loves him. And then yeah, when I pressed you for more, you admitted that you had to Google his name to make sure you spelled it properly.
Which that's true as well.
I find that amazing. And I want you to know this. Like, I've never been prouder to host a podcast with you than I was last night.
Well, look, we agree basically Rap died with Dipset, right? I mean, wasn't that the end?
No, Rap for me, like, the last time I truly loved Rap was probably like 2009-ish. And now, like, Kendrick is great and definitely like has his moments on albums. I just don't love him quite as much as everybody else.
Yeah, I don't know. Like I said, I literally have not listened to any of his music. I don't have a take on Kendrick Lamar other than what you already read. All I'm saying is, like, I had a very clear period where I loved hip hop. It, you know, starting yes, around Illmatic and the aforementioned Death Row Records, you know, that was sort of the beginning. And then, you know, you get through to the mid 2000s and then you just kind of grow out of it. I don't know.
I just love
against rap.
Yeah. It makes me really happy that you're not even participating in modern culture. You're just in a bunker dissecting DeRozan's game. And then you're out with your drone on some beach somewhere. Yeah. It's fantastic.
I was going to say, I got spreadsheets to write and drones to fly. Okay.
Exactly. We should also mention LeBron's t-shirt in that video that you tweeted, because I don't know what happened to the dress code, but that was like a white t-shirt with holes in it. And what I loved most about it was that it had to have cost like $800.
Oh, yeah. And he had $2 million worth of jewelry on. This is what I mean about pacing himself, though. Like, go back to the contrast I mentioned with Damian Lillard. Damian Lillard comes out with like a 9-piece suit. You know,
that's
he's got
true,
like undershirts and vests that I don't even know existed. LeBron, it's the first round. Like, he's saving his good suits for the conference finals. Okay.
Yeah, and he's a veteran. Chris, there were like 8 different people who checked in to tell us what Keith Bogensing was, as referenced on last week's mailbag. It refers to the way that the Nets used to start Keith Bogens for the first quarter, but only play him like 4 minutes a game as a way to figure out their front court rotation and blah, blah, blah. So, all right, so there you go. Keith Bogensing. I have a Keith Bogens story. He went to my school in 8th grade and for like a summer session and was expelled for stealing donuts. So the more you know. And then went to DeMatha and became a star and went to the NBA and had an amazing life. So it doesn't always matter what you do in 8th grade.
That's a great life lesson and good moral. This is why you listen.
This is why you listen to the end of the podcast. Marcos, this was another thing where like 8 different people wrote in. Marcos says, Andrew Sharp made a faux reference and credited it to Daryl Dawkins. All caps, that was Moses, an iconic moment. That's unforgivable. It is kind of unforgivable, but I confuse Moses Malone and Daryl Dawkins constantly. They both were starring like 10 years before I was born. So what do you want me to do, man?
I'm going to take the fall for this one. I got so excited to do my fake pronunciation joke about how it's pronounced four that I missed the bigger error, which was the complete misattribution. So that's my fault.
Yeah. Okay. Chris writes in and says, just started living with a girl who, when changing the toilet paper, does it backwards so that you have to pull from underneath the roll instead of just pulling from the front. Which kind of NBA player's media quote/tactic should I use to confront her about it? An Instagram about how my old roommates would have changed TP, the Rondo. A series of emojis of emoji tweets, the DeAndre. A soundbite to our friends about how we both could do better, the LeBron. Or skip our next date, the Kristaps. Looking for some advice from you guys. What do you think?
I think he mislabeled the LeBron here. I mean, I think the LeBron is actually sort of like a direct confrontation, maybe like taking the toilet paper off the holster and just like throwing it in disgust, sort of like LeBron's been confronting Tristan Thompson
right
throughout this season. But then also, you know, turning into a martyr about it. So going around and like changing all of the towels to be the certain way in your apartment, you know, maybe going to the kitchen and organizing all of the cans, like proving that you don't necessarily need her, you know, putting it all on your own shoulders to try to set an example for why she should be living up to the standards set forth in the house. I think that's the real LeBron.
Yeah, I thought through it. And he left off some options. I said, I don't do the Draymond Green where you scream at her that she's a coward and hope that motivates her to change. Also, definitely don't want to do the Phil Jackson where you email her on a daily basis about how toilet paper is like an idea and an organizational philosophy, and then also suggest different toilet paper techniques that she can work on.
1970s two-ply was the greatest. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And you could also go the Paul George route where next time you're out at dinner, you tell friends that you're a team, but then announce that some teammates need to change the way they behave if they want to succeed.
I have total trust in her. She's just horrible at this very obvious thing.
I'm just a little worried. I mean, have you been into our bathroom?
Loose lips, Paul.
Yeah, loose lips, Paul. Also, definitely do not do the Carmelo Anthony where instead of publicly demanding changes, you allow it to fester and then impregnate a stripper.
Don't be a bystander to your own bathroom.
Yes. No, but honestly, my first reaction to reading this question was, if you just moved in together and the biggest issue is toilet paper placement, you got to consider that a victory and just keep it moving from there.
That was, I mean, you've got a future as a relationship advice columnist. That was good.
Yeah. You know what it is? All right. Three more points here. Peter says, I just wanted you to know that my Swiss neighbor was not, in fact, the highest altitude European listener. I'm a Brit living in Austria, and I am sending you this message from 8,782 feet on the Rettenbach Glacier in Tirol, Austria. And then he
nailed all of that. You had perfect pronunciation on all those words.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. Clutch performance by me. And then he wanted to talk about the Nets. And Peter, I'm sorry. I don't have the energy to talk about the Nets right now. But I do hope that one day they will be less depressing. And Shahan says, with all due respect to Phil from Switzerland, I'd like to submit my bid for the highest altitude listener of the Open Four podcast. I was listening to the pod last weekend as I was hiking the Inca Trail to Machu Picchu, highest altitude, 13,828 feet. I'm so sad to say that I thought of Gulliver twice during this trip. Once when I saw the size of the huge stones that the Incas moved, nobody really knows how, I thought of Gulliver's aliens theory regarding Stonehenge. I totally buy it. And then second, I saw some Inca-themed chess sets, and I thought about getting one for Ben to knock him off the chess wagon.
Well, clearly I'm all up in his head. That's very interesting. You know, Andrew, we're like 3 weeks away from having an astronaut call in from the space station to claim his altitude as
yes,
the highest.
Please do.
I love this competition. I mean, I remember the good old days where we got really excited that we had a female listener. You know, now we've got people basically of all genders, creeds, religions, backgrounds, altitudes, longitudes, latitudes. It's really, you know, it's a one world open floor, I would say.
Absolutely. If anyone out there is climbing Everest, listening to us shit on DeMar DeRozan, please write in. We're very interested. For now, though, Shahan is the winner as far as altitude is concerned. Final question. It's going to piss you off, but Moritz, this is Moritz from Bologna, Italy. Yes, Italy also listens to you. And I wanted
There's
to fix...
There's no way that city is called Bologna. It's probably Bologna. Bologna, there's no way.
Yeah, all right, whatever. I wanted to fix the Nutella argument. Once and for all, he says, it is made by an Italian company and the correct pronunciation is Nutella with the U. Thus, Andrew, you were right since the beginning and you deserve credit for that. So there we go. We have reached a final resolution. I promise you, Ben, that's the last time we will discuss Nutella on this podcast.
Look, Two thoughts. One, I told you that from the start, that that's how it was pronounced. We knew that we were right all along. Australia was just dead wrong. The people in Ireland who were trying to claim their alternate pronunciation, also wrong. I just wish you had trusted me. But second, this was a beautiful story arc to this podcast. I don't know if you saw this, because we opened it talking about how everyone hates you in these emails, and we closed it with an email where, Andrew, you were right. Congratulations. I love that story arc. I mean, this is redemption. I'm going into the rest of my Friday feeling like we made serious upward momentum. You're no longer Tristan Thompson getting screamed at. Now you're Tristan Thompson holding down your championship ring. So congratulations.
It's great. It's great. Hit us up with some reviews on iTunes. Thank you for listening. We will be back next week. And Ben, we're actually not going to close with that email. We're going to close with Giannis Antetokounmpo.
5-star reviews.
DeRozan scored only 8 points and was just free throw.
This has been a digital media production. Find your voice.
Another great edition of Open Floor is in the books. Did you know Locked On has a daily podcast for all 30 NBA teams? If you're a Lakers fan, search Locked On Lakers. A Celtics fan, search Locked On Celtics. Warriors fans, search Locked On Warriors. Yes, all 30 NBA teams have a daily bite-sized podcast on the Locked On Podcast Network. Search on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team. Or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team.
It's the Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.